Education. Whether it's been a pain or a pleasure, we've all had to do it. You're listening to Crossing the Globe from the Be The Sound, where we examine an issue from the unique eyes of the LSE international students. Today we share an extended bonus episode of an interview on education with Jad from Syria. Hi, Jad.
Hi, Yaz.
So Jad is Syrian. Jad is going to talk to us a little bit about the Syrian education system. He has spent 12 years of his life in the Syrian education system. And in 2013, you left to do high school in Lebanon because of the war. Is that right?
Yes.
Also, Jad is a third year international relations student here at LSE. So, Jad, can you tell us a little bit about the Syrian education system? Obviously, education systems don't come from a void. They are influenced by how they start. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. So the education system, I would say the way it is right now, has been largely influenced by changes that were happening in the early 1970s. So when Hafez al-Assad became president, it was following a series of many military coups trying to enforce power on Syria, and Hafez trying to avoid any of that happening again. He wanted to enforce his rule to the best of his abilities, and he used education as a tool with regards to that. So one way he did it is by employing what is roughly translated to the Ba'ath Vanguard organization, and he incorporated that into the education system. And what it implies is that there would be a strict military discipline in schools, khaki uniforms, salutes before the school starts. There would be intense patriotic education about the history of Syria and the history of victories, of what they regard as the victory in 1973, for example, and just about the general features of the president and how they present him as this godlike figure.
Very interesting. Yeah. Definitely really interesting, considering education as a tool or a weapon, however you wish to see that, and a very powerful one at that.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about an experience or a particular point where you became cognizant and aware of this system and what it might be doing, and your thoughts on that?
Right. So before I, you know, present a very dark image of the education in Syria, I do have to say that it's not as bad as you might imagine it when you hear this podcast, for example. Education in Syria, in many ways, has some really positive figures. Like, we have almost universal literacy and almost universal enrollment in primary school, which is very impressive for the region. But having said that, of course, it comes at the cost of the quality of the education.
Absolutely.
So I myself have been a victim of that patriotic education that have been presented in Damascus, especially in a region that is not as familiar with the hardline approach of the Assad regime and the very brutal approach of the Assad regime. It is quite effective to use education as a tool to maintain that view of the president. So I would say up until 2011, I would rarely, if ever, have discussed any political discussions with friends or with family about political changes or suggested very clear negative connotations towards the regime. And I would say many of my friends do share that experience in Damascus, where discussions about politics are almost, they against the present, they almost are non-existent. So
and you think that's built through the education system and through a particular method of teaching?
Yes, I would say that when you're brought up constantly studying about the victories of the president and how benevolent he is and how great he is, then it is difficult to be comfortable taking part in these discussions. So I remember even as young as 9 or 10 years old, I remember seeing students in school during the first time that the president was going to get reelected in 2007. I remember students chanting slogans that they heard on television, very actively participating in celebrating him, which looking back at now is very bizarre, of course.
Right. Yeah. It's very interesting that you use the word victim.
Yeah.
Certainly, education is particularly loaded, particularly powerful because it's dealing with children. You're kind of, you know, you can't deny that we are so influenced by the way we are taught, both by parents and by education, and, and thus, by extension, the state. I was having a discussion with someone recently about protests, and I was saying quite proudly that my parents took me, when I was 2 years old, to the Iraq anti-war Iraq protests. And this person actually presented a counterview to me, which caught me a bit off balance, you know, whether my parents really should have done that. And whether we should be kind of imposing particular views on children. Now, I'm not sure where I stand on the point, but I think it's definitely a good inspiration for thinking about where should the line be drawn in terms of influence on children. I've got to say, in my experience of education, some of my favourite teachers were my religious studies teachers, my politics teachers, because we as students would hound them to ask them, you know, what do you believe? What do you vote for? Because obviously you're so curious, but they would never answer it. And now looking back on that at this point in life, I respect that so much because they knew their role was to provide teaching on the full spectrum and not to influence with their own experience.
Yeah.
So with that kind of inspiration, what do you think about where the line should be drawn and how to influence children to make sure that they aren't victims of an ideology or a particular education system?
Right. So I think in that debate, I draw a clear line between family and education. So I think it's a common assumption that we all have that the parents, when they advise you to do something, or if they take you to the anti-Iraq war protest, or they teach you about any value that they have, like veganism or any religion, it is assumed that they want the best for you.
Right.
Irrespective of what it means to them, they want you to have the best life, and it's not something unrelated to you. It's purely about your well-being.
Right.
So that's the environment that you have in a family. Whereas when it's something enforced by the government, it is very clearly not for your own well-being, especially in a government like the one in Syria, where their primary objective is to maintain their grip on power. So they would do anything to keep that safe. So for example, not adding politics and economics in high school is a very clear decision that they made to make sure that their grip on power lasts further. It's not something to benefit yourself, and it's not the reason you learn about all these victories in Syria very inaccurately is not for your own well-being. It's so that they maintain their grip on the political structure in the country.
Very good point. And I think it's got to be caveated also with this is a thing that all countries do to differing extents. I remember in the British system of history, there are certain topics that we learnt and certain topics were just conveniently brushed over. So the distinguishing factor is to what extent a country brushes or fudges the details of history.
Right.
But certainly, education is a tool of the state. Now, the next section that we wanted to move on to was getting into college and university. We're obviously here at a university in London, but university systems are very different and entrance to university systems are very different. So can you tell us a little bit more about the case in Syria?
So the way you progress into Syrian university, first of all, they're all public and free, which is good. But again, you have the downfall, which is the quality of the education. But regardless of that, going into university in Syria is through the Syrian baccalaureate, which is something all Syrian students have to do to progress into university. Now, the way it is determined what you study is not purely by your choice. You don't just go to the university and apply for a certain course. They do it strictly through your score. So let's say it's out of 310. In total, then you only go into medicine if you get 300 between 300 and 310. Now, those are very rough numbers. I'm just giving examples for the figures. But the ranking is the same. So if you get 290, between 290 and 300, you can go into pharmacy. If you have between 280 and 290, you can go into engineering, for example. So it's purely based on how well you do in total and what that means to where you can go and what you can study in university. And what that creates is a culture that values those two and three positions at the top. And it ensures that the brightest always go into these professions. So I was having a discussion with some family members who have progressed into university. And I asked them, what do you think about just allowing anyone who wants to be a doctor to go into medicine and anyone who wants to be an economist to go into economics? And they said, well, if we implement that, then everyone would pick medicine. And that is a very important point, is that it's not purely about the current system.
Right.
It's about the culture that becomes embedded following years of implementing that system. So people are all aiming to study medicine. They're all aiming to study pharmacy, even if they don't really want that for themselves.
Right, because that is societally valued.
Yeah.
The most. It's very similar to the Egyptian system. Again, it's like this pipeline. And right. even if you don't want to enter it, if you're very bright and you reach that 300, as you mentioned, the assumption is that you become a doctor.
Right, exactly.
You know, that's the given. Exactly.
And what's difficult is that if you want to implement change in that regard, it's most of the work is with the people. Most of the work is with the culture and trying to undo what this education system has enforced on people for years.
Mm.
So if you get to the point where people are demanding for a change in the education system, a systematic change and not just amendments, systematically, then you've done 90% of the work.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
There's certainly a point to be made about why is this kind of system of pipelining and very fixed structure is for the economy and how flexible and prepared that is to changes. I mean, you know, we have a changing world economy and globalization, and having a workforce which is so stratified and inflexible.
Yeah.
You know, how wise really is that?
Right. So from an economic standpoint, I would say it is very clearly inefficient, because you're not placing the best people for a certain course in that position. You're putting people based on a very general concept of being bright and being smart.
Right.
So the people who value a certain course are not going towards that direction.
Right.
So it's very, very obviously inefficient economically. But what I would say the regime values is that politically it's very beneficial for them, because they ensure that the brightest does not go into politics or economics or courses that that may danger their position in power or may challenge their position in power. So they make sure that whoever the brightest people, which they encourage very clearly, they encourage education and all things like that, but they make sure that they go into medicine, they go into pharmacy, they go into engineering, and that's something very useful, I would say, for the regime in Syria.
That's a very interesting way of thinking about it. I hadn't considered it that way. And obviously, we'd be totally remiss to not consider the current situation. We're obviously talking previously about your experience prior to the civil war.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about the education situation at present?
Yeah, I would say, obviously, with all the bad things that we mentioned about the system prior to the uprising, currently it's way, way worse. It's there are about 10,000 schools that have been, or maybe more, that have been damaged or not in use anymore, that have turned into shelters, no longer functioning. Teachers rely on volunteering. They rely on foreign aid. They don't really have a sustainable system throughout the year or curriculum.
Right.
They go underground. They make sure most schools in active battlefield areas are underground. And obviously commuting to and from school is a huge issue because you never know what's going to happen every day. So right now, the situation is very fractured. And obviously, because Syria is very politically fractured at this point, then if you go to different regions in Syria, you will find different curriculas. So if you go to the Kurdish region, you will find a curricula in Kurdish with classes in Arabic and classes in Syriac, but generally it is in Kurdish. And if you go to opposition areas, you will find what is largely the normal Syrian system, but it is it excludes all the history and all the patriotic education part. If you go to areas where there's more radical Islamist groups, you will find philosophy classes that have been removed and more Islamic emphasis. And if you go to the regime-held areas, then you will find what we were discussing, all the history, the inaccurate history, and the emphasis on patriotic education, which is further emphasized at this point.
And what does that mean for students like yourself? You know, you have the opportunity to... You're here in London. Students who wish to go to universities abroad.
So I was very fortunate to find my way outside of Syria and get into a good university. But obviously for foreign institutions right now looking into Syria and trying to bring students out, it means that they can no longer rely on the existing assessment found in Syria.
Right.
Because, I mean, not to mention all the cheating that is now prevalent, all the leaking of answers, the regime has used its own tools to prevent some people in areas like Aleppo, for example, in 2013 to do their exam centers.
Right.
So it's a very broken system which foreign institutions cannot rely on anymore. And it will be very difficult for the Syrian student to make his or her way into different institutions abroad.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Again, you know, the broader issue which is being brought up here is the control of opportunities and control of education and what that means for people, for children, but as we've talked about university, older students who are wanting to explore specialities. So can you, this is obviously such an important topic, and thank you so much for sharing with us.
Of course.
Is there a concluding point that you'd like to give to draw this all together?
I hope that people who are partaking in the post-war development for Syria are putting time for amending this very broken education system, because we've had years of students who have not even seen a school in their life, maybe. We've had students, the brightest in our country, flee the country. So this is very long-term negative consequences to the country. And even if we get security back, and even if we get our health back, then we still have something very difficult to deal with. So I hope that people who are part of this post-war development period try to find a way to fix that. So people in Geneva right now, for example, are discussing the amending the constitutions. I hope they find common ground in how we could place a good education system and start educating Syrians all around the country.
Brilliant. Now, for those who want to explore this with Jad further, he's obviously incredibly informed on the topic. Jad has recently gone to the UN Constitutional Committee talks in Geneva about the constitution in Syria. So do find him on campus to have a chat about this really essential topic. Thank you so, so much, Jad. This has been really interesting.
Thank you very much, Yaz.
Thanks for listening to Crossing the Globe. The topic this week has been education. Your presenter has been me, Yasmina O'Sullivan, and our interviewee has been Jet from Syria. The fantastic music is by Ashley Leo Mazing. If you'd like to share stories from your country, please become a contributor on the Beaver Facebook page. For more content, check out the Beaver Sound on Spotify.